White Rocket Entertainment.
White Rocket Entertainment, podcast number 269.
You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
10, 9, 8, 7, ignition sequence started. All engines are started. We have ignition. 2, 1, 0. We have a liftoff. We have a liftoff, and it's lighting up the area. It's just like daylight here at Kennedy Space Center as the Saturn V is moving off the pad. It is now clear to the top.
And welcome to the White Rocket Podcast, brought to you by White Rocket Entertainment in association with the Earth Station One Network. It's one long conversation with a variety of guests about the best of popular culture. I'm Van Allen Plexico. Hey, I did that without notes. Look at that. I've done it so many times. I'm here solo today, and we're going to try a little experiment. This is a sort of a different show in two different ways. One way is I'm recording it both on video and audio at the same time, so I can put it up on the White Rocket Video, White Rocket TV channel on YouTube, and also so I can put it up as a White Rocket podcast. That's one way. The other way that it's different is that it's a discussion topic, but I'm doing it solo. Now, you know, if you've listened to the show for any amount of time, you know that I do at whiterocket.podbean.com. You know that I do occasionally do individual shows where I, you know, I'm on by myself, but they're usually me talking about something like I'll do a reading from one of my own books or some special report like the Amber to Television special or something like that. But rarely do I do a discussion topic, and I don't have any guests on, but I'm doing it that way myself just for a couple of reasons today, and that's because this is going to be a Space 1999 episodic discussion where I'm just talking about Space 1999, particularly the premiere episode Breakaway. Now, in the future, I may go forward and talk about more episodes of the show, and if I do, I may include more than one episode in a show. But for this, for the premiere episode, to talk about Space 1999, talk about Breakaway, for this show alone, and I'm showing it on the video now, I have 6 pages of notes. I'm rattling them for you to hear, see? 6 pages of notes. So I thought, you know what, let's just do Breakaway. I imagine for future episodes as we continue through Space 1999, the number of pages of notes will get smaller and smaller, particularly in the second season. But for now, I think I want to just talk about Breakaway, which is a good way to talk about the entire series in general, right? I mean, Breakaway establishes everything about the show. It establishes the characters. It establishes the basic idea of what the show is about. Some of the early themes. Not entirely do we get the early themes. I mean, because, you know, the greater themes, particularly of season one, are going to be the mysterious unknown force, or MUF, M-U-F. You don't really get that in this episode, other than maybe the fact that they survive and the moon isn't shattered like Thundar the Barbarian's moon. You don't get the theme of them out, you know, human survival. Perhaps the Earth has even been destroyed during Breakaway, and so they are spreading mankind's seed across the galaxy or the universe or whatever. You don't really get that yet either, because they're kind of fixated on one destination by the end of this episode, which I'll get to when we get there. There's a number of major themes that run through, particularly the first season of Space 1999, and really you don't get any of them more or less in Breakaway. But what you do get is a very ambitious episode that really reaches very high, but also kind of cribs a lot from another source, and ultimately, I think, fails in several critical ways. But if nothing else, it does get the ball rolling. Excuse me. It does get the ball rolling on the show and sets up what will be a very 1970s episodic series rather than a more modern contemporary show where there's a continuation of plots over multiple episodes. You know, one of the reasons I want a revival of Space 1999 is I want to see all new stories, and I want to see, you know, a whole new show, of course. But a big part of it is I want to see Space 1999 done in the way that contemporary shows are done, where you have ongoing plot lines across multiple episodes and across maybe multiple seasons, along the lines of Babylon 5 or Lost or Battlestar Galactica, the more modern version, you know, or something like that. I would just like to see what they could do with it if it's not purely episodic, not purely hitting the reset button almost every episode. So, and the only major change is coming at the end of a season, the beginning of another season. So, with that being said, let's go ahead and dig on into some of the into this episode. I've got plenty to say about it. I really sum Breakaway up as an episode, as a standalone work, excuse me, as great ideas, but really poor execution. Now, not execution in terms of the special effects. Certainly, the moon looks fantastic. I absolutely believe and buy that it's, you know, supposed to be the moon. I love the eagles. We'll talk about that. The space buggies, the hardware. In visual terms, and I this show is great and it's very convincing. In fact, I would argue the only thing that really visually does it a disservice in a way is it's got a very cold antiseptic look to it. The uniforms are beige and white with only a little color on a sleeve, maybe, and if you're medical, your sleeve is white, so it's even more bland. The sets, the furniture is white plastic, which gives it a very distinctive look. Nothing else looks like this, but again, and then the walls are kind of white. Everything is beige and white on this show. And so, again, it gives it a very distinctive look, and I like it, but in another way, it keeps the show from looking like anything else, and that's great. On balance, I like it, I think, but I just feel like it all comes across as very almost literally vanilla because there's so little color. It's almost like a black and white TV show. If this was a black and white show, you watch it on a black and white television, and yes, there used to be things called black and white televisions, you wouldn't lose a whole lot. I mean, the little bits of color you do see on the show, like maybe, you know, somebody's sleeve of their uniform or the red cross for the landing pads of the Eagles, it shows you that I'm having a hard time thinking of very many times you really see much color on the show. When they fire a stun gun, when you see the travel tube going through the tunnel and there's lights, you know, like orange or red lights lit up. I mean, there's not a whole lot of color to this show. Even the screens on the comm locks and on the wall displays, if they're not black and white, they sure seem to be black and white. So not a lot of color. So it looks wonderful, if a little bland. And the ideas are great. I love the idea of 311 men and women hurled across the galaxy or the universe or whatever. I don't know that the writers really understood the difference. Just like the writers on the old Battlestar Galactica didn't really understand that a star system is much smaller than a galaxy, among other things. The writing, the specific writing, and particularly for this episode, is just very weak. Let's go through it now. Let's go ahead and dig into this episode, and you'll see what I mean as we go along. We're going to talk about the good stuff. And again, I don't want to sound negative. I'm just being critical of the things that disappointed me that I think could have been better. And I'm going to make suggestions of how things could have been better, and maybe if they ever reboot the show, will be done better. In fact, let me just go ahead and say, because I have no problem self-promoting, because as I always say, if you don't promote yourself, who's going to? You guys know that are my regular listeners and White Rocket supporters. I've written 15 novels already. I'm writing novel number 16 right now, and it is basically heavily inspired by Space 1999. This is a property that I dearly love. In fact, I've got the $100 Eagle transporter spaceship on my bookcase upstairs. It's like those on watching on video can see. It's about this long. Seriously, it's about that big. It's huge. It cost me about $100. I did not buy the aluminum add-on components. I painted stuff silver. Okay, I saved myself about another $150. But I love Space 1999. I love the property. I love the ideas. And so I'm writing a book now, and I'll go ahead and tell you, it's called Alpha Omega. Yeah, there's a little hint in the title, okay? But it's called Alpha Omega. And it's being written for Prose. And it'll be along, hopefully, by the end of this year. So be on the lookout for that. That's not something I've announced publicly. I'll just say it here for you special listeners that might be interested in this kind of thing. Okay, so I keep promising, and I keep not doing it, so let's get into the show a little bit. All right, so we have the opening, the cold open before the credits, where it's very 2001. You have that arrangement of the moon in the foreground, the Earth, and the sun, with the moon sliding over to eclipse the Earth. Now, if you turn that 90 degrees sideways, it becomes the opening credits of 2001, A Space Odyssey. So, very first shot of this series, they are saying, hey, look, we are 2001 A Space Odyssey, the series. And that's exactly what Season 1 was. Season 1 is like if they said, what if we took 2001 A Space Odyssey and made it a TV show and throw in some aliens and some monsters and cosmic mysteries where everybody goes kind of, you know, at the end of the episode while the music goes, doo, 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 doo. Like that, and they're all going, again, I say it with love, but that is what they did. I'll tell you some more ways that it kind of references or copies 2001 as we go along. Now, we see that we actually start the show. I didn't notice this. I've watched Breakaway a dozen times in my life, if not two dozen times, and when I watched it today, I realized for the first time that the show opens on 9/9/99. It's September the 9th, 1999. 4 days later, of course, is when the nuclear waste disposal area goes up. So it opens on 9/9/99, and we get the moon buggy. The little moon buggies are awesome. Great miniature work by, I guess, Brian Johnson and the other effects guys. Fantastic. We actually see the eagle for the first time, and we see an eagle as a unloading vessel. The eagles have many different components that can be slotted up into that undercarriage, right? Because I always think of the eagles as like those big industrial helicopters that have a giant rotor blade or two rotor blades, some of them, and they have like the open section that can come down and pick up a thing and carry it. And that's basically what the eagles are. The eagles are giant industrial helicopters, really. And so we see one with the undercarriage that carries nuclear waste disposal, nuclear waste drums or barrels. And I have to say that when I was a kid, I had one of those, I guess, Corgi, I think they were Corgi, stainless steel or cast, die-cast metal, yeah, eagles. And mine was the nuclear waste disposal eagle. And I bought that one because it was white with red trim. And the other one that they had was green. And I watched the show, and I don't remember a green eagle. So That's why I had the white one with the nuclear waste barrels. Plus, it was a neat little thing where you could rotate it and the little barrels would come out, and they had a string with a magnet on it so you could lower it down and load and unload the nuclear waste barrels. That was pretty cool. That was a pretty neat little toy. It also had the spring-loaded legs, so it actually would – you could set it down and it would bounce just like the real Eagle. It seemed like a lot of them had wheels. I had some with the wheels where you'd pull it back and let it go and it would run like a car, which never made any sense to me. But this one actually had the little landing pads which with springs, which was cool. My big one does too. So the Eagle's unloading nuclear waste barrels, and what we see is that they're actually putting more nuclear waste into Nuclear Waste Disposal Area 2. And, of course, that's going to be very important to the story as we go along. I do like the idea. I mean, the nuclear waste and the radiation on this show highlights everything that's cool about it and everything that's ridiculous and dumb about it. I mean, basically, when you learn the whole deal with Space 1999, each person that learns it has to make a decision within themselves, which is, do I like that idea about the nuclear waste explodes, it was being stored on the moon, it throws the moon out of orbit without destroying it, and they go off flying across the universe on the moon having adventures. Do I like that? Can I live with it and just not worry about it? Or does it put me so off the idea that I just can't stand the show? I know plenty of people. I have lots of friends that say, I do not like Space 1999 primarily because the first season theme music. No. They don't like that either. But primarily because of they just cannot buy into the idea of the moon, of the nuclear waste, the bad science, and the moon getting blown out of orbit. And that's, you know, whatever works for you. I saw it when I was a little kid. I was probably in first or second grade, and I fell in love with it. I think it's neat. I think it's cool. But it does highlight one of the issues, right, which is the idea that they are storing nuclear waste on the moon and it explodes somehow after causing people to die from magnetic radiation, and then it propels the moon across the galaxy. So you either buy that or you don't, really, and that's all there is to it. So then we see Eagle 2, interestingly. Eagle 2 brings Commander Koenig. And this is to the base, and this is another 2001 A Space Odyssey reference, because it's very much like when Dr. Haywood Floyd was on the Pan Am shuttle going up to the space station and then going and then taking the ship down to the moon, to Tycho Base, I guess it was, Tycho Crater. When he was on the Pan Am flight, you saw the flight attendant come out and bring him coffee or something, and walking with like Velcro slippers to hold her down. And that's essentially what you have here, except without any pretense toward gravity, because the Eagles have artificial gravity somehow. In other words, the Eagles on Space 1999 have a technology similar to the Minbari on Babylon 5. Do with that what you will. Okay. So Koenig lands, and he meets Victor Bergman, Dr. Bergman, who already knows him, and they're chatting, and they run into Commander Gorski. And by the way, on the way down, I believe it is, Commissioner Simmons tells him that he has already relieved Commander Gorski. Now, Commander Gorski is interesting, but I'm going to more about him in just a minute when we run into him. Okay, that I got a little ahead of myself. So, yeah, Koenig is told by Commissioner Simmons, more about him coming up too, of course, that Gorski's been relieved, though he's still on Alpha, and so John is now the commander of the base. And his job is to, quote, put man on Meta, unquote. There's a planet. Now, I'm not too clear on this either. This might either be that they just don't explain a perfectly reasonable scientific concept, or it is that they are just totally making crap up again. Right. But that's okay. The idea is that there's the planet Meta, which is way outside of our solar system, and apparently it's far enough away and important enough because some kind of signal is coming from it, like it has intelligent life or something, or at least a TV transmitter, a radio transmitter or something, that they are going to send the Meta probe out to visit planet Meta. And they're sending two astronauts, that's it, in a sort of a gigantic version of an eagle. It's got the eagle front nose like a lot of ships on this show do. But it's got like a great long body, much larger than an eagle, I believe, to go all the way, you know, have enough supplies and whatever else to go all the way to this planet. Now, question, of course, I have is if this is a planet, either they're going to another solar system like Alpha Centauri or something, which seems like quite a reach, especially since they say that the planet Meta is approaching, like it's making its closest approach, almost like it's another planet in our solar system. But if it was another planet in our solar system and it's that far away, it would be frozen. It would be way out past Neptune and Pluto, and it would be frozen. So I'm not sure how or why or where or anything about planet Meta. I just don't know, and perhaps the best thing to do is don't ask, though we may talk about it again at the end. All right. Now, this is, again, another callback to 2001, A Space Odyssey, because, again, you have two astronauts. You're on the moon. You have two astronauts at a space station in orbit, and the two astronauts, who are obviously the ones that are sick from that opening where they one of them at least went crazy, they're going to take a ship out to another planet far away, and that's just exactly Discovery. In fact, one imagines that if they had actually launched the Meta probe on Space 1999, it would have had some kind of a HAL 9000 computer. Of course, they do have a HAL 9000 type computer, but she is on Moonbase Alpha, not on, I guess, the Meta probe. So it would have also been cool if they could have launched the Meta probe anyway. And or that would have been, or maybe you said that was the second Meta probe, and then the spaceship that they rendezvous with, that they discover lost in the Sargasso Sea of Space in Dragon's Domain, if that had turned out to be that ship. See, that would have all tied together. That's what I mean when I say that if you do this show over, you can think all that stuff and plan it in advance, and you can tie all those things together. And how cool would that be, right? I mean, how cool would it be if they had just gotten the Meta probe launched, and when they encounter it later in Dragon's Domain in the Sargasso Sea, they wouldn't believe the astronaut, I guess it was Lee Russell, Dr. Russell's husband, right? It would have been cool if they had first said, oh, he had the exposure to the magnetic radiation, the magnetic energy, so nobody believed him, not because of other reasons they came up with on that show, that episode, but because there was a pre-existing condition, so to speak, right, that they were suspecting that there was a problem. That's another thing I want to mention is they set up the idea that everybody on Alpha has been exposed, I guess except Simmons, has been exposed to magnetic radiation because they've all flown over the disposal areas. You could have done something really interesting with that going forward that would have tied in with Lee Russell and Dragon's Domain. So, anyway, and also the idea that Simmons wasn't exposed, and so he thinks he's the only rationally intelligent person on the base, and as soon as he disagreed with Koenig, he could have started saying, well, no, he's got brain damage, and I'm okay, I should be the commander. Oh, there's so much that could have been done with this, it would have been awesome. Okay, so Koenig finds out about the virus infection story, which is another 2001 callback. I'm going to be saying that a lot. I already have said it a lot. Where, you know, when Dr. Floyd got up to the space station on 2001, he was having to give out this fake virus story to keep people away from the moon base because they were trying to cover up what was actually happening there. And so once again, you have this virus story as a cover up for what's actually happening on the moon base. Sounds familiar, right? Okay. Apparently, by the way, the virus infection or whatever it is, and we don't at this point know what it is a condition that makes people psychotically and suicidally claustrophobic, because every time somebody comes down with it, they start screaming, "I've got to get out of here," and smashing everything. That's a bad enough condition anywhere else, but when you're in a moon base with vacuum outside, that's very bad. Now we have the opening. And gotta say, I love the season one opening of Space 1999. It's got a great theme song. I love the music on this show. This music is really spectacular. It's been said before, and by people much smarter on such things than me, that the composer, whose name escapes me at the moment, I'm sorry, the composer and the orchestra that or whatever it was, the musical body that did this theme music, they did so much more with less, right? They did all this in very quick time, and they gave it a grandeur. They really gave this show a sense of epic sweep. Just imagine 1999 without that background, dum da da dum dum dum, you know, all that great background music that we have. It's amazing. I love it. Okay, so we come back after the credits and we discover, we see Commander Koenig and Victor running into Commander Gorski. I love Gorski, and this is where I was going to say, I was going to mention him again. What a great character he could have been. We are told that he has always been very flexible, says Koenig. He's a survivor, basically, says Dr. Bergman. So wouldn't it have been interesting to have a flexible survivor as one of Koenig's main rivals still on the base, like if he was trapped there? What would Koenig have done with him? What might have been done with him? Imagine, I'm going to go ahead and say it. Imagine if Commissioner Simmons had remained on the base. I mean, I know that the episode, the Earthbound episode that he gets this great send-off is a really terrific episode with Christopher Lee and all. And you could do that at the end of the season, but maybe just one season, you know, if you'd planned it out like Babylon 5, maybe just one season where Commissioner Simmons is totally done with Koenig. He just can't stand Koenig anymore. And so he tries to overthrow Koenig. He tries to, you know, de-appoint him and appoint Gorski instead or himself. And Koenig says, "No, I've declared martial law, basically. I'm not stepping down." And the base sides with Koenig at first. But then Commissioner Simmons starts working to undermine the confidence in Koenig and props up Gorski maybe as a replacement. And then maybe Gorski, you know, ends up taking charge for a little while, and they lock Koenig in a cell. You know, maybe after one of those times where he goes out on his own and gets captured or disappears or something, and they think he's dead, or they capture him, arrest him. And then finally he comes back, and Gorski says, no, I have to step down. Koenig is the rightful commander, which drives Simmons up the wall even more because Gorski does the right thing. There's so many cool plots you could do with those two characters, and to me, using Simmons one more time and not using Gorski at all is an absolute crime. It shows how the plot, the story, was like the least most important thing when they did this show. All right. Let me see. So moving on. Comlocks. We see Comlocks for the first time with those cool little TV screens. I think they had cables running out the back that went up the sleeve of the actors so they could be holding it and talking to a little TV screen, and you could see the TV screen. You just couldn't see all the cables because in, obviously, 1975 or whatever, there was no way they were making a TV that small. So Koenig meets some of the other people in the base. He already knows Dr. Bergman. He already knows Paul Morrow, and he already knows Alan Carter, which I thought was interesting. I get the sense that he's been the commander before. This is not his first stint, his first tour of duty there. I think that's conjecture, but I think we get the sense he's been up there before and is sort of put back in charge, kind of the way, pardon the sort of the strange analogy, but it's kind of the way when U.S. soccer was dissatisfied with Jurgen Klinsmann, they went and got Bruce Arena back. So Gorski is like Klinsmann and Koenig is like Bruce Arena coming back to take over during a bad patch because we know he can get the job done, you know. That's certainly the sense I get from Simmons. But he doesn't know Dr. Russell. And it's interesting when they have their whole little opening scene where they meet each other for the first time and they're discussing things. And Koenig calls the Metaprobe ship the space flight of the century, which is very unusual. I mean, I guess he means the 1900. I mean, the 20th century, not the 21st yet, I guess. It's September of 99, though, so maybe, you know, I don't know when it was supposed to launch. Maybe on January 1st, 2000. I don't know. But anyway, so he's talking to Dr. Russell, and we find out that Gorsky refused, or it may have been from Dr. Bergman that we find this out. We find that Gorsky refused to let Dr. Russell report any of her findings. Now, later we find out that's not exactly true. Apparently she reported them, or Gorsky secondhand reported them to Commissioner Simmons, and it ended there. So I don't know whether, if it was Victor or whoever it was that told John that Gorsky refused to let her report her findings, maybe they meant publicly, because clearly her findings have been reported to Gorsky and to Simmons, and they said, "Eric, it's not getting any further than this." So I'm not exactly sure what they mean there when they say not let her report her findings. I guess maybe just like not talk to the press, or maybe they... maybe that person assumed she hadn't been allowed to since nothing had come of it, and they didn't realize Simmons was just sitting on it. But anyway, so Helena tells John it's not a virus, it's brain damage, but we don't know what's causing it. But there have been 9 deaths in all so far, and all of them associated with Nuclear Waste Disposal Area 2. Well, I'm thinking, there's your big warning flag. If people are dying of something and they all went out to Nuclear Waste Disposal Area 2, you got to think, even if it's like Legionnaire's disease outbreak in Disposal Area 2, it's probably something to do with Disposal Area 2, you know? So that's pretty frustrating as a viewer. Now, here's something that occurred to me, and I made a quick note about it. What's interesting is... the radiation poisoning or magnetic energy poisoning of the astronauts, which is caused by the flare-up in magnetic radiation at the 2 nuclear waste disposal areas, that's the reason why John Koenig is put in charge of Moonbase Alpha, and it's also why the moon is blown out of Earth orbit. So if the nuclear waste disposal areas had blown up without emitting that deadly slow-acting magnetic radiation or magnetic energy, whatever. It's never entirely clear, honestly. I've watched it a bajillion times, and I still don't fully get it. But if the moon had blasted out of orbit without giving this long buildup of people getting brain traumas, you know, and dying, then Gorsky would have been the commander, and Koenig would have been on Earth, presumably. And this show would have been about the adventures of Commander Gorsky and Helena and Dr. Bergman. And I have to wonder, how many episodes would the Alphans have lasted with Gorsky giving the orders instead of John Koenig? Now, he seems an affable enough guy when we meet him, and he must be intelligent or he wouldn't have been the commander of the base. But you still have to wonder, you know, exactly how the show would have gone if not for that slow leak of magnetic energy. It would have been a very different show. Simmons says he'll just send up a, quote, whole team of top medical men to basically overturn Dr. Russell's diagnosis and presumably come up with one that Simmons wants them to come up with, because he is still playing the bureaucrat, ignoring the scientific problems and the reality and the danger, and just looking. His eyes are on the prize. He is totally focused on launching the Metaprobe. Come hell or high water, come nuclear explosion and moon blown out of orbit, he doesn't care. He's getting that Metaprobe launched. So it would have been interesting if that medical team had come. Instead, what Koenig does is he negotiates out of that. He horse trades down to – he wants to get Simmons to just stop sending up nuclear waste for a little while. And it's funny because Simmons' reaction to that is, oh, heavens forbid, we can't stop sending up nuclear radiation. Like Earth is just cranking out megatons of nuclear radiation, nuclear waste, I mean – constantly, and they can't stop sending it to the moon. So, which makes you wonder, why not just shoot it into the sun instead of storing it on the moon? Are you putting it on the moon because you're ever going to use it for anything? Why keep it around if you don't have to? I mean, and it would have probably been cheaper just to attach a rocket booster to those barrels and shoot them off to the sun than to actually transport them in manned vehicles out there and place them one by one in the carousel on a little conveyor belt into that carousel and it's in the elevator and all. It's just, man. That's a lot of nuclear waste, by the way. We must have, I mean, freaking Rwanda must be using 10 nuclear power plants by 1999. And by the way, I'm convinced that this show should have taken place a lot later than 1999, but there's no doubt in my mind that they chose 1999 because it's the other date that sounds cool besides 2001 of that same time period, right? I mean, you wouldn't make it 2013 or 2017, some distant time like 2017. It's just that doesn't sound good, right? Plus, we're nowhere close to having Moonbase Alpha, and it's 2017 as I record this. Okay, so he wants to stop sending up the nuclear waste, and Simmons says, I can't do it, but I can do a temporary pause to it. So, okay, and even that was difficult. So Simmons wants everything he wants, and he doesn't want to do anything in return, basically. Now, it's funny because I made a note that at this point, Koenig uses the comm lock for the first time, or maybe the little TV screen, I forget which, to call Paul Morrow, who ends up being kind of his, not second in command, really, kind of sort of second in command, but sort of like the logistics guy in main mission. And he calls up Paul, and as the camera comes on, we see Paul and this girl like this. And I'm thinking it's supposed to probably mean he's talking to her up close on that screen and like going over some technical material with her. But honestly, it looks like Koenig interrupts them when they're making out. Every time I watch it, I think, hey, what was Paul doing? And I think also that wasn't Sandra. Paul. So it is funny that the comm locks could, or the communication system could be busted being up to something when that camera just comes on while you're standing there. So Koenig and Victor with a pilot take an Eagle out to Nuclear Waste Disposal Area 1. And this is pretty dumb. Of course, what they do later, what John does later, is even dumber because they already know, right? They already are pretty sure that the nuclear waste disposal areas are involved and that they are a big part of, if not the entire problem. And yet they go out there. In fact, I want to say almost every Eagle that goes out there crashes until the ones at the end. And the one that brings them back here doesn't crash. But almost every other one does. So they're so convinced of their diagnosis that it's not radiation that they just think it can't be anything else. And so Victor points out the Nuclear Waste Disposal Area 1 hasn't been used in 5 years, and there's no radiation out there. However, it is a beacon. It is a check, like a landmark that the Eagles fly over before flying on to Nuclear Waste Disposal Area 2 or wherever else on the dark side of the moon that they're going to, because they're on the dark side of the moon, those installations. So we see the moon buggy again, which is awesome. And the pilot starts freaking out, and he gets a bad case of I've got to get out of here itis syndrome and starts smashing the glass with his helmet. And what was interesting to me is that the very first time he takes his helmet and just smacks it on that glass, the glass looks ready to go. It shatters like a spider web immediately. And I'm thinking, I could take a motorcycle helmet and smack it on the windshield of my car, and it wouldn't do that much damage. It might not even crack it at all the first time or two. So I don't know what contractor supplied the windows for Moonbase Alpha, but they need to get their money back, Alpha does, because those were some pretty cheap windows. So we get to see the stun gun for the first time, the little staple U-shaped stun gun that has a handle like a regular gun, goes out like a regular gun, and then curves back down a straight bar down in front of your hand that you can use your thumb to shoot it, basically. You can put it on stun or kill or whatever. And it has different apertures along, like knuckles, different apertures along the way, and it fires a blast. They use them mainly to stun people, but they do use them for other things, too. The Metaprobe astronauts are dying. One of them dies. The other is near death and eventually dies, too. Reminds me, again, pairs of astronauts like 2001. This is what it took to get through to somebody like Allen, he's got Metaprobe fever, you know, just like Simmons. And they have to point out, it's not just that we're delaying, it's that our astronauts are literally dying, okay? Just as they start to... just as we're worried about the two astronauts dying, Sandra reports that there's a steep rise in the heat output at Nuclear Waste Disposal Area 1, and the cameras burn out immediately. There's this lightning storm going on, and all the domes, all the nuclear waste domes are glowing bright red. So clearly we're learning something new about nuclear waste, which is that it suddenly can spontaneously heat up and create magnetic energy blasts. I don't know what kind of nuclear reactors they're using on Earth in this 1999, but they are using some seriously freakish nuclear waste, nuclear power fuel that becomes terrible waste. So this is the one that really is a head-scratcher. Koenig takes an Eagle out alone and immediately crashes it. But he doesn't crash it like the others because of his brain going out of kilter, because he's the commander, right? We can't lose his brain. He crashes because of the magnetic fluctuations of Nuclear Waste Disposal Area 1. Now, they rescue him and bring him back, and Dr. Russell's checking him over. And honestly, I thought Koenig in this scene is written so terribly. He's a big jerk because he says, "No, see, I'm fine. There's no damage." And she says, "Well, that's not the damage I was looking for, meaning I wasn't looking to see if he had any broken bones or anything, dummy. I was looking to see if you have a giant red blob inside your head like everybody else that's flown out there." So she says, "We're not looking for heroes." And I'm thinking, it's not that you're not looking for heroes. You're not looking for corpses. I think that would have been an even more effective line from Helena is, "We need an answer, Commander. We don't need corpses." Right? We've got enough of those already. Because he fires back at her with, "I didn't know you cared," which is a clever TV line. But in this case, it's way too smart-alecky for John Koenig talking to a woman he's only just barely met recently who is trying to look out for the lives of 311 men and women on this base. So she reads in the Riot Act, and good for her because he needs the Riot Act read to him. Let me pause here for just a second in the middle, more or less. We're coming into the home stretch, actually, because I had a long preamble, and thank our patrons on White Rocket. We depend on and appreciate everything that you folks do. We have our platinum level, top level, the Eagle Has Landed level patron, Nicholas Cottrell, whom we desperately appreciate. There's also Bill Matthews, Michael Kirshner, Joey Miller, Jared Albrick, Dave Powell, Mark Squire, and David Medinas, each of whom contributes every month to help keep our video and audio shows on the air and new ones being made whenever we have the time here in White Rocket Studios to put something together. And by the way, I hadn't done a video for you guys in a while, so if you're listening on the White Rocket podcast, that's great. I'm hoping the audio will come out good using this new system, which I recently installed. Thank you. But I'm also hoping that I can put this up as a special video for the patrons for a couple of weeks before we put it out for everybody. So, okay. Thanks to all of our patrons. And by the way, do check out, if you haven't on audio, check out on through iTunes. All you got to do is search White Rocket Entertainment on iTunes, and you can hear lots and lots of shows. We're doing, gosh, anywhere from one to two or three shows a week now on the network, and we cover lots of stuff. We're doing a Babylon 5 rewatch. We're doing a Quantum Leap rewatch. We're doing the Lord of the Rings trilogy, where John Ringer and I have one more movie to go on that, and book and trivia to go. We'll be doing Game of Thrones soon. We do James Bond on Her Majesty's Secret Podcast. That's part of the White Rocket Network. If you want to hear any of those things, just subscribe to the White Rocket Podcast, to White Rocket Entertainment, and they're all on the same feed. You get them all through iTunes, or go to whiterocket.podbean.com. All right, so back to the show. Victor finally figures out it's magnetic energy, not atomic or nuclear radiation. Okay. And we've all been exposed to it, says Dr. Russell. This is something that's never followed up on. So once again, you have a neat idea in the pilot. That's three loose threads they could have followed up on and don't. We kind of get a follow-up on Simmons, but it's not very good. We could have gotten a follow-up with Gorski, and we could have gotten a follow-up with everybody's been exposed to magnetic energy / radiation. Would have been great. Now the big danger is nuclear waste disposal area 2. And this is a much larger, much deeper, I get the sense, concentration of this super dangerous future nuclear waste. And so they send a remote control Eagle out to kind of measure the radiation. Once again, the Eagle crashes. Now, you get a sense that this crashed Eagle crashes because the magnetic field around the nuclear waste disposal area 2 expands suddenly, which is another warning that something bad is about to happen. Although it seems like I remember, maybe it was a different version, maybe it was the record and comic book years ago that went with this episode, but I seem to get the memory that when that Eagle crashed into it, that precipitated the big explosion. But here, I think it's just it crashes because of the expanding field of magnetic energy. And you get a surge of heat. And this is where Koenig says, now we're sitting on the biggest bomb man's ever made. Now, if you've listened to the previous Space 1999 episode that I did with Anthony Taylor a couple of years ago, he and I talked about the entire show in general. And I joked about how that was a reference to the show itself. Again, I say it with love. It's just kind of funny. But it is kind of funny that he says it. So Koenig orders priority signal Alpha 1, which is a signal to Simmons to say, you know, this would Babylon 5 would call this ultraviolet code, right? And when Simmons calls him back to try to find out what's going on, Simmons is told that Koenig is unavailable. So Simmons hops in Eagle 1, which I guess is kind of like Air Force 1 in a way here. Simmons hops in Eagle 1 and zips right on up to Alpha to find out what's going on. And Koenig tells him, well, I'm available now. And the question I have is, did Koenig warn him beforehand of the danger, or just leave him so in the dark that he felt compelled to come up? And did Koenig want him to come up? Because I get the sense also, because it's never directly addressed. I've listened to these dialogue exchanges several times now, and it's never made entirely clear whether if Koenig. You get the sense it's not that he wasn't available, it's that he didn't want to be available. And if that's so, it's because he wanted Simmons to come up there so he could confront him face to face, I think. So I get the sense that this was all a ploy by Koenig to actually make Simmons come up there so that Koenig could negotiate with him directly. And in an environment where Simmons couldn't just turn off the radio, the television connection with him. So Koenig gets that, and what that means is that Roy Dotrice is Commissioner Simmons, is up on Alpha. And it's funny, too, because when he arrives, he even has one of the beige tan space Moonbase Alpha suits on, although if you notice, his sleeve doesn't have a color. It's just the same color as the rest of his uniform. I feel like in the other episode, Earthbound, they give him a color of some kind, maybe a command color or something. But in this episode, his sleeve is just the same color as the rest of the uniform. So maybe that's the color they reserve for visiting dignitaries who are not part of the hierarchy, you know. He's a government bureaucrat, not a member of the Alpha team. By the way, Roy Dotrice appeared on Babylon 5, among other places. He was the Earth official that was negotiating with the Centauri, and he told he told Captain Sheridan to apologize to the Centauri in one episode, which I'm doing the rewatch for the Babylon 5 rewatch, and I haven't gotten to that one yet, so I can't remember exactly when that happens. It's, I want to say, somewhere in season 2, though. Maybe it's early season 3. I'm not sure. But anyway, you may also know Roy Dotrice. He's the voice of the Game of Thrones books, the Song of Ice and Fire books, on audio. So, and he does a great job with the different voices in Game of Thrones. Okay. So now we, Simmons says, what is there to be done? What can we do to alleviate this emergency crisis situation? And the Alphans, you know, Koenig and Bergman and everybody say, we need to rip out all those barrels, all those containers of nuclear waste, and distribute them over the lunar surface, like spread them out enough that they are no longer a concentrated, like a concentrated explosive. And that makes perfect logical sense. So we get this great sequence where the Eagles are flying out like the big industrial helicopters they are. They're reopening those sealed up nuclear waste disposal cylinders, which must go deep down into the moon. They're not just like on the surface. They are, you see an elevator going down in one of them in one scene. So there's a lot of stuff down there. And they're ripping them out. And carrying them with their little magnetic thing, like on my Corgi die-cast metal eagle, and they're dropping them, boom, boom, boom. But there's so many. Plus, you got to bear in mind that there should have been an enormous danger that the eagles would all start crashing. And indeed, we are told that there are navigational failures on two of the eagles during this operation. So they didn't forget about that. The eagles are just performing exceptionally well in a magnetic field that should have wrecked them all. Okay, but they also don't mention that all those pilots are now exposed to this magnetic energy, and so they could have followed up on that and done... You remember there was an episode of the original Battlestar Galactica where all the male pilots came down with food poisoning or something, and so you had all these female pilots that stepped forward and became Viper pilots? You could have almost done the same thing here, have an episode where all the Eagle pilots come down with that magnetic energy poisoning and got the things in their brains, and then have some, you know, have the women, have the non-pilots, even male or female, step in and fly the Eagles, and then you could have some godlike alien character come in at the end and save everybody's fire, of course, if you wanted to, unless you want to switch to those pilots. Alan Carter takes the Commissioner's Eagle, which is Eagle 1, up into lunar orbit to scope it out and see what's going on. And about that time, somebody yells out, "Commander, it's going up!" And then the nuclear waste disposal area 2 starts exploding, or lightninging and exploding. Koenig says, "Abort, abort!" And Paul is saying, "All Eagles return to base immediately." And the Eagles start coming back. It's a good thing they did, too, because we wouldn't have any Eagles available. They had every single Eagle was being used, I believe they said. Every Eagle but one was out ripping up nuclear waste barrels, drums, and Eagle 1 had Alan up in lunar orbit kind of supervising, watching what was happening. So there's chaos on Alpha. The thing explodes. I wonder how many died. They never really say anything about how many people died. They just say how many there are at the end of the previous episode. The moon starts to move now as the nuclear waste disposal area explodes. It becomes, as Victor says, a gigantic rocket motor, and it's pushing the moon out of orbit. And the G-forces we are to understand, which would be through acceleration, not just cruising along, the G-forces are so great that everybody's pinned to the floor and can't do anything until it's too late. Alan, I think, could have probably gotten back to Earth. If you want to tell me that the Eagle One with one person on board was not capable of getting all the way back to Earth at that point, when it's no greater distance really than it was before the explosion at that point. It's just a, it's just kind of started moving, but at that point he could fly back. So that was interesting. The space station or space dock or whatever it is destroyed. Yeah, this is one thing that I wanted to mention. You've got Alan going, come in, Alpha. Alpha, please answer me. Alpha, do you read? Alpha, come in, Alpha, answer. And I'm thinking, you know, it's funny how in every TV show and movie ever made, pretty much, people are begging somebody on the other end to answer. And it always drives me crazy because it's always that they just can't. That the signal's not getting through, or everybody's unconscious, or everybody's dead, or there's no receiver. For whatever reason, when you do that, it's not getting through. So, nobody's ignoring you, right? Nobody's choosing to just blow you off. They physically can't come to the phone right now. Okay, Alan, chill out. Sudden deceleration. Don't know why, but okay. They realize that they cannot make it back to Earth. Before they realize that, Commander Koenig calls for the computer to evaluate enacting Operation Exodus. And, of course, as we know from subsequent episodes, Operation Exodus would be the immediate and complete evacuation of the moon base to the nearby planet, Earth or whatever, right, by Eagles. And the computer says that there's too many unknown factors, including constantly changing G-forces, which I'm like, okay, to calculate a navigation. I'm thinking you just aim at the big blue and white round thing and go, but apparently not. So they cannot make it back to Earth. Operation Exodus is a no-go. Oh, and by the way, let's see. They've mentioned it a couple of times already, but I made a note here. Commander Koenig knows the computer guy, and it's not David Kano. It's not Kano. It's Uma. So I'm not sure who Uma's supposed to be, or if they just replaced the casting with Kano with the next episode. I really don't know, but that was interesting. So there's 311 men and women. At the end, they're looking for any signal. They're watching the news for a little bit. And it's talking about how they can't mount a rescue effort. And then the static takes over, and you can't see anything. And then you get the meta signal, and you realize they're getting further away from Earth, but they're getting closer somehow very quickly to planet Meta, wherever that is. And honestly, I have no idea where that's supposed to be based on anything. We were not given enough information on this episode to have any understanding of where planet Meta is, okay? And so Koenig ends the episode by saying, September 13th, 1999, Meta signals increasing. Yes, maybe there. Okay? And then you never actually go there. Meta is never mentioned again. The whole moon essentially becomes the Meta probe, but it never actually goes to Meta. So, and again, I'm not sure how it would have, because I'm not sure how Meta could have been anything but a freaking iceberg at this point. Okay, so that is Breakaway. Now I'm going to give you a few of my overall conclusions about this episode and about where the show is going at this point. This is an ambitious show in a lot of ways. It's what we call a high concept idea, right? I mean, it's the whole show is based around the premise that the moon makes a kind of a cool interstellar spacecraft, just one you can't steer. And in that way, the show that is the most like it later is Stargate Universe, because instead of being trapped on a moon, they are trapped on a big starship that they can't steer or control for the most part, which I think is fascinating. One of the many reasons I really like Stargate Universe. I like the idea of human ambition being one of the big flaws that is revealed here, because, you know, Commissioner Simmons and the bureaucrats of the space agency, they are determined to put man on Meta. They want a manned landing on Meta. And this is causing the bureaucrats to overlook or willfully ignore or outright deny the truth about the what's killing people, about how bad of a situation it is. I mean, Simmons would have propped those two dead astronauts up like Weekend at Bernie's and sent them if he could have. That's how determined he was to launch the dang Metaprobe. It's these human bureaucrats that are ignoring the truth because they're doing what they want to do, and they're creating a situation that is actually bad, where people are dying of the magnetic poisoning, apparently, the radiation or whatever you want to call it, but is going to be far, far, far worse when the actual moon, the nuclear waste disposal area, explodes. So the whole idea of the whole thing is caused by bureaucrats who keep putting nuclear waste on the moon, won't stop putting nuclear waste on the moon, and then lie about what's happening because of it. I like that angle a whole lot, and I think a lot more could have been done with it. The writers of this show don't seem to understand much about radiation or nuclear power or nuclear waste or a lot of physics-type, chemistry-type science. Again, this puts some people off. I really like it. I can ignore it. It was a 1970s TV show, and if there's one thing you have to do with 1960s and 70s TV shows, it's ignore the science or you're never going to enjoy anything. Again, I said I like the moon as a non-steerable ship across the galaxy. And then lastly, you needed a rival on this show to John Koenig. I was saying earlier, and I'll reiterate here, either Simmons or Gorski or both, preferably both, would have been great foils for Koenig. There are episodes here and there where there's a moment or two where people are not sure they want to believe or follow Koenig, though it's usually after he's had brain damage or is saying crazy thinking, apparently. But it would have been, I think, really great to have ongoing adversaries, antagonists that could have kept popping up with ongoing plots and subplots. And one of the ways that Simmons and Gorski could have attacked Koenig would be to say, he didn't even try to get us home. I think we could have made it, but he didn't even try. And that would undermine his authority, and they could eventually get him overthrown, which would be a great plot line for the first or second season. Okay, so that is, there's my 6 pages of notes. There's my 6 pages of notes on Space 1999 Breakaway. We brought this sucker in right about an hour. I'm looking forward to talking with you about Matter of Life and Death and some of the other episodes that are coming up soon. I particularly enjoy Voyager's Return, where Voyager returned several years before Star Trek The Motion Picture, and a very different Voyager, but still dangerous, wanting to talk to Earth and dangerous. It's interesting how Space 1999 did that first. There's a couple of others. I really like The Last Sunset. Ring Around the Moon is cool. I don't have all my discs here. I was just looking over to see. Anyway, so we're going to get on out of here for this episode. I hope you enjoyed this. This is pretty much as detailed of a look at Breakaway as I could possibly give you. In the episodes to come, we'll go back and look at some more episodes of the show and talk more about the characters. I want to talk some about Dr. Bergman and how cool he was. What a tragedy that he doesn't get to be in season two. We'll talk about Alan, the reconnaissance pilot, the Chief Eagle pilot. Dr. Russell's interesting, if a bit kind of bland and cold. Koenig could have been better, but he is a good leader. He comes across that way. And Paul, I think, is a very interesting character. And Sandra, too. So, okay, we'll leave it for there. That was Space 1999, Episode 1, Breakaway. The rocket's going to get on out of here for another episode. And we will see you guys down the road.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network, your station for all things geek, classic, current, and beyond. Be part of the crew at ESONetwork.com.
This has been a White Rocket Entertainment production.